With words inscribed at her base, our Statue of Liberty welcomes the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. But even as the clock is ticking for the mission to evacuate Afghans ahead of the Taliban takeover, talk has already begun about how welcome those refugees will be here in the U.S., with many shouting, "Not in my backyard."
Is it really our responsibility to welcome thousands of potentially unvetted refugees from Afghanistan? All day we've heard phrases like, "We promised them." Well, who did? Did you?
We will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we're invaded.
We go inside the debate tonight on Banfield. Also ahead, get vaxxed or go to jail. We're not at that point yet for everybody, but if you commit a crime or get accused of a crime and you haven't yet rolled up your sleeve, you might just face a judge who makes that decision for you. Is it legal for a judge to make it mandatory for those who are facing parole or jail time to get the vaccine? What one judge is saying, that's straight ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. I'm Adrienne Bankert, filling in for Ashley. We have a lot to talk to you about tonight, including breaking news. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul warning all U.S. citizens to avoid the airport there due to security threats. Now, if they are already at the gates, they should immediately disperse. We're monitoring this. We'll bring you updates as they become available. Meanwhile, we've been in contact with Ashley's former translator from her day's reporting in Afghanistan. We call him Jawad to protect his identity. Is he still with his family in Afghanistan? And in Qatar, waiting to be reunited with him, there are family members. They sent us this exclusive video. Here is his wife and family in their Qatar hangar.
This is my little daughter sleeping. It has been 4 days. We got stuck here inside this big hangar. No one says nothing about it. The status of all these people are unknown. We hope they should come up with a decision.
And again, that's the place they are calling home for the time being. They've been through a rough journey. They have very little left. They're tired, frustrated, but they're being taken care of and fed in what appear to be clean conditions. Unfortunately, back in Afghanistan, the brutality of the Taliban is on full display. Here you see the Taliban arresting a man who allegedly stole a phone. We're about to show you that video. They actually put that man in the back of a police pickup truck. We're going to go to that in just a moment. Here you go. They shaved his head. They painted his face black. This is some kind of punishment for robbers. Joining us tonight, we are very pleased to bring you Matt Zeller, advisory board chair for the Association of Wartime Allies. It's an organization that helps those, including translators, get to the U.S. through visas. And also on the ground in Afghanistan is Pashtana Durrani, founder and executive of LEARN. You're there in Afghanistan. And of course, you are trying to help spread education, particularly to girls. But Matt, let's just start with you really quickly. Tell our viewers about your nonprofit, how you're working around the clock to rescue those on the ground in Afghanistan.
Well, I'm going to be as quick as I can because I'd actually like to hear from your other guests. I think her views are probably the most important at this point. She's the one who's going to be, you know, suffering the fate that's coming unless we can get her out. I mean, that's what our organization is trying to do. We're part of a much broader coalition that's tagged itself as sort of the digital Dunkirk. We're helping as many people as we possibly can get to that airport and get to a better life. We've been warning for months now to the Biden administration that if they didn't conduct this evacuation when we had pleaded with them to start, which was back in February, that this was the likely scenario that was going to befall. Unfortunately, we've been proven right. We didn't want to have been proven right. And now our goal is simple. We're trying to keep those flights going for as long as we possibly can. We're crestfallen and dumbfounded that the President of the United States has allowed the Taliban to dictate essentially the timetable of the exit. And now it's seemingly they're the ones who are also preventing the people that we need to get out most from being able to reach those flights. It breaks my heart to see pictures of, you know, flights leaving with even a single empty seat, let alone hundreds.
Yeah. It does make a very broad and staggering picture here of the conditions in Afghanistan on the streets. Pashtana, are you putting yourself at risk by speaking to us and other news organizations from Afghanistan?
Well, like every person who right now can speak English or has worked with foreigners is at risk. It's not me only, it's a lot of other people too. So I wouldn't say not only me, a lot of other people are at risk right now.
And you actually using the internet that you can to broadcast this message to let us in America, but all around the world, people know what's going on there. Can you just describe the conditions? I hear that electricity is sporadic, internet is not accessible for everyone. Maybe describe some other things that you're seeing there.
The right now, the major issue is the humanitarian crisis. The banks are closed, so nobody can access any sort of money or funding or budget or any sort of those things. And if you know about Afghanistan, Afghanistan is not a very rich country, so the people really need food. They need clean drinking water. They need access to all kinds of medicines and stuff. And it has been hard. I myself have been getting calls that people are selling their own family and home stuff just to feed their children. So that's a huge issue. Public administration is totally paralyzed. The schools are not yet open. Every other day I get a notice that schools will open up, but they haven't. And at the same time, the whole infrastructure, not only just electricity or internet, those are privileges right now. A normal infrastructure, normal going out is an issue right now.
Okay, tell us this from your perspective as a woman in Afghanistan, the Taliban telling the world that they're a new organization, that they are a different organization entirely than they were 20 years ago. Do you feel that any part of that statement is true?
And let's believe them when they do it, when they appoint a women minister who's going to address our issues right now, right? They say we are okay with the women, we are changed. You're changed. You can speak English now with a good accent and you have a very better PR system than you had in the past. The world is listening to you, but nobody's asking you to prove your point.
One quick question before we go to Matt again, and I'm glad you're able to stay with us. I'm glad your internet's working. Why have you not fled the country? Have you had the access to get on one of these flights before they shut down the airport?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I had access to all these flights 7 times, to be very exact. And I did put a few other people instead of me. Two of my coworkers just reached France a moments ago. So I just got a call from them. One of them is in Dubai right now and a few are in Qatar. So yes, I did have a chance, but I didn't leave because there are 7,000 girls who are still dependent on me and we still have to make it through that. And you can't put 7,000 girls on that plane.
Wow. The selflessness of that act. 7 times. Matt, I want to bring it back to you. President Biden's August 31st deadline just days away. In Secretary of State Tony Blinken's press conference today, he said our quote unquote involvement in Afghanistan will not cease. What do you think that means?
I don't know. I don't believe a word of this administration anymore. They've tried to gaslight this and claim that this was, an inevitable outcome. And that it would have occurred no matter what time they attempted to leave Afghanistan. They've conflated the U.S. military decision to withdraw with the idea that it would have engendered at any given time a chaotic evacuation. The numbers that they put out, they still won't let us know how many of those people are actually Afghan wartime allies versus U.S. citizens versus other foreign nationals versus people who just randomly were able to get on a plane. Our organization, the Association of Wartime Allies, is currently tracking some remaining 65,000 Afghan wartime allies and their families out of the 88,000 that were supposed to have been evacuated. So, we're really concerned that the people who are most vulnerable might not be getting out. And I got to be honest, it breaks my heart to hear my fellow panelists, say that she has to remain behind and she's courageous. I mean, she's the hero of this interview by and large. She's extraordinarily brave to do this, to put herself out there, but to purposely and willingly remain behind because she knows she needs to take care of people, because that's what a leader does. I wish President Biden would see this and learn from her example, because here's the thing. She said, we can't just put 7,000 people on a plane, but we can. We're the United States of America. We have the most powerful military on the planet. We absolutely have the resources, and we've done the math. We could get all of these people out at the current rate of evacuation if we were allowed to continue it at a daily clip from now until September 5th. And then we'd be done. We'd have every single person that we've identified, including all 7,000 of her women on that plane, getting them to a better life and a better future. And I can't imagine why we've decided to make the decision where we're going to condemn them to this existence, where they're going to, forgive me, but I fear that they're going to wake up tomorrow, you know, on September 1st in Afghanistan, in which women can't leave the home, in which there is no place for them in the workforce, in which every aspect of the Taliban that we fear, you know, is going to return. And this time, they're going to be far better armed than they were in the 90s.
I do have
far more capabilities.
I didn't mean to cut you off there, Matt. I know you're impassioned about this. Obviously, you've had experience there on the ground in Afghanistan. I just wanted to ask Pashtuna one more question. Do you believe the U.S. should help the Afghan people? And do you believe that this evacuation, this ceasing of the occupation of the U.S. military forces was the right thing to do?
See, I'm going to be honest with you. U.S. staying, U.S. is not like a Marvel, like, you know, the way you guys show it in your movies, that the world is on fire or the aliens invade and then all of a sudden U.S. is there to rescue and the army is there to rescue. I mean, like, sure, everything else is there. But in 20 years, all we could see was like, you know, not that there were no gains, but at the same time, you know, everything came up with the limited resources. Not everything was accessible. Not every development was accessible. Rural Afghanistan was left out of this new Afghanistan. And that's the reason this chaos came into being. And now you just bring in other people, and every 2 decades you bring in another government, another institute, and you say, okay, that's yours, and it's chosen by Afghan people, but it's really chosen by the US, right? And at the same time, it's not about the military staying. Military left, it was not an issue. But letting human civilian casualties, seeing all the human rights abuses, standing by it and legitimizing Doha deal, that's where the U.S. went wrong. And the U.S. should have had the leverage to stop the Taliban, to stop the corrupt leaders, to do whatever they wanted in Afghanistan, but they didn't. They let the corrupt leaders be more corrupt. They give them every kind of access to money. They let the Taliban do any kind of human rights abuses, and they were so okay with that. That's where, you know, it makes you question, if they are world leaders, why are they okay with letting Afghans and humans being abused? That's where it comes into question. The U.S. troop had to leave at some day, right? It's not that question. The fact that human rights abuses happened, U.S. had the leverage, and U.S. still stood by and didn't do anything, that makes you question and wonder the leadership position that they assume.
Thank you so much, Pashtuna Durrani. Thank you for joining us. And we know how risky that is for you and others. Matt Zeller, thank you for your heart and sharing your perspective. We want to wish you both the best. When we come back, escaping the Taliban is just the first step for thousands of Afghans. What awaits them once they make it to America? That's next. Welcome back. Even as the clock is ticking for the mission to evacuate Afghans ahead of the Taliban takeover, talk has already begun about how welcome those refugees will be. So what will happen to the thousands of people seeking political asylum and protection here in the States? Somebody who knows this issue very, very well is Bob Kerry, the former director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement during the Obama administration. Bob, first of all, thank you for having the time with us this evening. But this is not uncharted territory. A few years ago, a similar debate was going on about Syrian refugees coming to America. So you worked in the Obama administration during that time. What would you say that history has taught us?
Well, I think history has taught us that we have the capacity to do this when we want to, when there's political will to do it. Historically, refugee resettlement has enjoyed broad bipartisan support. And I think it's important to recognize as well that refugees who come to the U.S. are among the most are the most thoroughly vetted individuals under any immigration status. They go through at least 7 levels of security check by multiple federal agencies, and they go through a face-to-face interview by skilled interviewers who've been very experienced in this. So, one, that they're experienced vetting processes that are very rigorous. too, that there are communities where there are many church groups, nonprofits that have a lot of history in doing this. They have expertise. They help people integrate into communities, which the U.S. has a very long history of doing. And there, it's part of our national identity and reflects the values on which this country was founded.
Doesn't it seem like this is a much more sensitive time, though, as opposed to a few years ago in terms of us solving the world's problems? And I think that's probably why a lot of people are feeling a little tense about this particular issue. Do you think that the bandwidth of America, especially after the past year and a half, will allow for that same kind of compassion?
You know, the U.S. is still, I do. And it's not the U.S. alone. Many of these people will, if possible, stay in the region where they have family connections or where there are other countries may, in cooperation with the U.S., provide them refuge. But the U.S. has certainly had a history of welcoming people in crises and integrating them successfully. So I think there absolutely is capacity if there is the political will. And I think, you know, for many of these people, they've put their lives at risk. And some of them have had family members killed, people who've contacted me today. One case, their father and their sister were killed in the last 3 years because of their U.S. affiliations. This is someone who is in hiding, who worked as a contractor for the U.S. government, who has received credible death threats. These are the type of people we should absolutely be providing protection to, as well as other minority groups who really are marked for execution. They include, you know, women who have been teachers or are teachers, people associated with academic institutions, religious minorities, LGBT individuals who will not be protected. Some of them can't get access. Many of them can't get access to the resettlement program. It's not an option. You know, it's important to be safe, that it be orderly, that people are vetted, but we have a history and the capacity to do that.
Let's listen to a soundbite of this same conversation from a different network, and I want to hear your thoughts. Listen to this.
Is it really our responsibility to welcome thousands of potentially unvetted refugees from Afghanistan? All day we've heard phrases like, we promised them. Well, who did? Did you?
We will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we're invaded.
Or as another pro-Trump propagandist put it, raise your hand if you want this plane landing in your town.
Okay, so there are a few things I'd want to hear from you about. One is this vetting process. You've said it a couple of times, but there are critics who think that there are people who can slip through the cracks. Quickly, would you say that this is completely unsubstantiated?
It is completely unsubstantiated. In my experience, you know, 7 levels of security clearance at least by multiple security agencies in the U.S. government.
Okay.
You know, face-to-face interviews, biometric data, you know, collection, family, family tracing, background information, interviews. You know, it's the most comprehensive system that I know in any country, and it absolutely assures that people are who they claim to be, and that they are in need of protection. You know, I think the point when they say who and why do we prepare or why do we protect these people, there is a history there. These people, if there was not an explicit obligation to protect them. Their lives, they, for the most part, in many instances, their role in Afghanistan was to protect U.S. troops. They put their lives on the line for our forces, whether they be troops or NGOs or nonprofits working in the region. And I do think we have an obligation to them. And if we don't do this now, who in the future will stand by the U.S. and protect our military or our nonprofits or our humanitarian aid workers? If we say we won't stand by them, who will stand by the United States in the future? I think that's an important question to ask. And, what if we do not protect them? It's a dramatic departure from past practice in numerous conflicts, whether it be, you know, Vietnam or Bosnia, people who are in dire need of protection. The definition of refugee under U.S. law is for people whose lives are in danger such that they can't return to their country of origin. Different categories, but some because of their U.S. For many, it's because of their U.S. affiliation.
Well, one quick question
because
for you,
they're identified.
I apologize. And again, it's timing that I'm interested in. I want to make sure that I get this last answer from you. We only have a minute left. In terms of the swell of refugees coming to this country, and the soundbite that we heard, you know, the concerns over when will it end and could it go to the millions? What do you say to people who criticize the U.S. response?
Well, I think it's important to look at what the numbers actually are. I mean, I think look at them, you know, look at the program. It should be safe and orderly. You know, that's important to protect people and not to cause confusion and mayhem. So historically, that has been the case. People are vetted. They're put in a safe situation or in a secure setting where if they are not vetted prior to coming to the U.S., I mean, that they're in a military installation, somewhere where they can be thoroughly, you know, reviewed before they're allowed to enter our community. And then in many instances, they may be going to places where their military colleagues are located, or many have family members in the United States, some of whom are citizens or permanent residents who've been here for a long time. So it's not as though this is, you know, when they are portrayed as an alien population, you know, many of these people speak English, are highly educated, and have been working for American organizations for many, many years. And I think the portrayal of them as a threat is patently false and, you know, in many instances, offensive. They've been allies of the United States, and we do owe something to our allies, I believe.
There is going to be a lot more conversation about this. Bob Carey, we appreciate you taking a few minutes with us tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, to vax or not to vax?
He asked me, was I vaccine? I told him no. And he asked me, do I plan on getting vaccines? I told him no.
All right. Turns out there's a downside to that very strong opinion and decision, and it has nothing to do with sickness. Up next. Welcome back. As we speak, just over 52% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated against COVID. Just 52%. And every day the pressure grows to get the other 48% to get their shot or shots. Just today, Delta Airlines announced its unvaxxed workers will face a monthly $200 surcharge in their health insurance premiums. But what if the pressure wasn't just social or about your job or even political? What if a judge told you to get vaxxed or you're going to go to jail? An Ohio man is facing that choice tonight. Brandon Rutherford sentenced to 2 years probation for drug possession if he rolls up his sleeve. If not, it's 18 months in prison. Brandon and his attorney, Carl Lewis, are joining us live from Cincinnati. Is it Carl?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Bakard. Thank you very much. I'm so honored to meet you like this. I'm a big fan.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Mr. Lewis. We appreciate it. And Brandon, thank you so much. I love the fact that you feel so close to us that you could just Zoom from your car, because that just makes me feel like we know each other very well. So,
that's the difference from a young 20-year-old and an old man like myself. It's past my bedtime.
Well, no, it's like selfie. We're just FaceTiming each other tonight. So first for Brandon. Okay, the judge discussed the COVID vaccine in court. What did he say? What did you say?
Well, all he said was that I was going to have to take the vaccine.
And you said, I ain't doing it.
I was telling him that I didn't want to take it, yes.
Okay, you got some company in the background, too. I love that. Why?
The police just stopped us.
Oh, okay. Well, make sure to tell them that you're doing something very important and it's okay. Hopefully it's all right.
Do y'all mind if I step out and talk to him?
He's right there.
Stay right
there.
Yeah. Don't log off. Just pause or something. Okay.
Sir.
Pause, yeah.
Okay. I haven't had that happen on television before.
Hey, your ratings are going to go through the roof now.
I would just say it's interesting. So Carl, as his attorney, you know, had you heard about a requirement like this ever before?
I've been practicing law now 31 years. Never in my life have I heard anything like this. And when we received the judge's statement that, and I order you to be vaccinated within 60 days, you could have heard a pin drop in the courtroom. Every lawyer, the court reporter, everyone stopped and said, did I just hear that right? So it took everyone aback.
Okay, so, and you mentioned the judge's statement, so let's read it to you, actually. It says that this defendant, let me see, hold on, I'm trying to look it up on my iPad and on the teleprompter at the same time.
No worries, take your time.
Let's see, this defendant was in possession of fentanyl, which is deadlier than the vaccine in COVID-19. Is that not true?
It's a fentanyl-related compound. I'll explain that.
Okay. What does that mean?
Well, what happened in this particular case, I'm so glad to have said that because I've seen some of the comments. You guys are doing a phenomenal job giving this case traction. Fentanyl-related compound claims and says there was a mixture. And in this particular case, as Brandon was just on his way to pick someone up and we asked him to pull over to do this interview, you see the police stopped him. He was in a car with three other individuals. Those three individuals took off running. Brandon did not run, and they found fentanyl, and everyone in the car was charged. So it's a constructive possession from our perspective. He has no record, so it wasn't in his pocket, wasn't on his person. It was in a vehicle where there were three or four other individuals.
Okay, so really he was being charged for being with or associated with somebody who had fentanyl-related compounds.
Correct. And if anyone, and again, I said I've been doing this 31 years, Brandon has no record and did not want to take a chance of going to the Ohio Department of Corrections, where at the time, up to 8 years. So you say, listen, if I can get probation, get this expunged from my record, I'll plead to the reduced charge of possession, not trafficking, and move on with my life until we heard that crescendo. And in 60 days, you're to get vaccinated.
Wow. Okay, so Brandon, I got to ask you, what was your objection to getting vaccinated?
I didn't get to tell him that I didn't want it, but it was just said that I had to take it. And when the court session was over, I asked my lawyer, did I really have to take it? And he said we just talk about it and all that. We never got to object because we was too shocked the fact that he even said that I would have to take it.
So are you going to get the vaccine or are you going to face jail time or are you going to fight this?
I'm going to fight it, and no, I'm not going to get the vaccine.
And it's because you just believe you shouldn't have to.
Right.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both, Carl Lewis, Brandon Rutherford. Please, awesome. Both of you be safe. And I hope everything works out there, Brandon.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Lewis. All right. Okay, we want to bring another voice into this discussion, a very knowledgeable voice. Nushin Saifi is chief judge of the 11th Judicial Circuit Court in Florida, based in Miami. Before that, she spent more than a decade as an assistant public defender. Judge Saifi, thank you so much. Okay, we know that some of these cases, even though it's completely different circumstances, but this case isn't necessarily unique. Why?
Well, it's not unique because I think this has been something that's been pondered and discussed in courts across the country right now as a way of trying to entice people to get vaccinated.
And a federal judge in New York actually refused to grant bail to an unvaccinated drug suspect until she rolls up her sleeve. We found out about a judge in Louisiana who's been cutting community service hours for defendants who agree to get vaxxed. But the fact is that this is something that can be legal. Though, is it appropriate? Is there a lot of legal standing for forcing people to get the vaccine as part of the conditions of parole or jail time?
So I'm not going to talk about, I think people can differ on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. The judge in Louisiana did it in, as far as I can tell, in a way that was legal, based on what I reviewed and read. Because the judge in Louisiana basically said that if you get the vaccine, you can use that as credit towards your community service hours. So the person is not forced to get the vaccine. The person has the option of getting vaccinated or doing the community service hours. So in that scenario, I don't see anything legally incorrect with that.
Okay. And again, you're saying it's still given as a choice.
Right. In that situation, the person, the individual who's getting sentenced, has the discretion to basically get vaccinated or choose to go forward and do the community service hours instead. And there's been a lot of discussion about that amongst my colleagues and across the country. And I think that most people agree that is a legal way of doing it.
Okay.
I'm not here to pass on what's legal in Ohio, but that the Ohio situation is a little more problematic because the judge was ordering him to get vaccine and not giving him a choice.
Okay, I want to bring this up to you. The federal judge who made getting vaxxed a condition of bail said unvaxxed people pose a danger to the community, even potentially causing their deaths. Is that wrong? Is that right?
All right. So I'm not here. I can't tell you what's wrong or right. And honestly, I think this is, it's going to be interesting to see. There, the law has not yet caught up with the pandemic. I mean, we are living in, as everyone has said for the last 18 months, these are unprecedented times. And it's definitely been an unprecedented times on a lot of different issues in the legal system. And I think what we're going to see in the, you know, the days, months, years ahead, as some of these cases reach our appellate courts, you know, it's at this point, I think it's anybody's guess on some of these issues where the appellate courts are going to come down. But right now, I can't, you know, I think it goes without saying that this is absolutely a public health concern, and vaccinations, all of our scientists, our doctors are telling us that vaccines are the only way out. Clearly, it is a community service, I think, to get a vaccine. You're not just saving yourself, you're saving others. But whether or not that is legally something that a judge can order as part of a sentence, I think remains to be seen. Again, I think in the scenario where you're giving a person the option and you're giving them essentially credit towards community service hours, it's another story. I think it's fine. But the only other thing I would point out is that when people are being sentenced, their liberty is absolutely being restricted. That's the nature of sentencing. Sentencing is ultimately a restriction on freedom. So ultimately where the courts, where the appellate courts land on this is remains to be seen. And I think, again, we're going to see a lot of new areas of law as a result of the pandemic.
All right, Judge Saifi, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's going to be really, really interesting to see where this one goes. We appreciate you. Up next, let's talk about something a little different. How about the MMA? Do you like mixed martial arts? One of the most brutal sports out there. Imagine what it would take for somebody to succeed in the ring if they only had one hand. Winning single-handedly takes on a whole new meaning. It's something right out of a movie. Now it is the inspiring story of Notorious Nick, right after the break. Nick Newell. He's been making headlines, filling seats for years as an MMA fighter. I mean, this is full contact, kicks and punches and holds in the cage. But how in the world did he do things like this with just one hand? It's an inspiring story. It's now the subject of a new motion picture titled Notorious Nick. It launched in theaters August 6th. It's available for streaming now. Nick Newell, welcome. Welcome to Banfield.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you for being here. I know it's a little late for you, maybe past your bedtime, but I don't know. So thank you for joining us from the East Coast. Did you ever think they were going to make a movie about you one day?
I don't think anyone ever thinks that they're going to make a movie about them. I don't think you just sit around and live your life and make a movie about you. But for me, it was really surreal, the whole process. So I'm very grateful that people found my life interesting enough, because for me, I was just out here chasing my dreams, following a passion and doing what I love to do.
So talk to us about chasing that passion, because you were born with just one hand. And I would think that a lot of people would be surprised that your passion would be to wrestle and MMA fight. Did you have your detractors? Did you have your critics?
Yeah, as you can see, you know, I was only born with one hand. So I'm holding up the camera with my other one.
Okay, and thank you for doing that.
No, I don't feel like I ever have anything to prove to anyone. I grew up. I love martial arts movies, and I started wrestling in high school, and I just kind of fell in love with competing, and I said, oh, I'll do one fight, and I kind of liked it and had a good time, so I just kind of kept it going.
And what did your opponent say when you would walk out into the cage?
I mean, I don't know. I'd have to talk to them. But, you know, I think for people to take the fight, you have to, you know, obviously you have to be pretty tough, because I have a lot of skills. I'm a pretty good fighter. You know, I was an all-state wrestler and I wrestled in college. You know, I can kickbox, I can grapple, I'm a black belt in jiu-jitsu. So really, I just spend 6 days a week, all day, every, you know, working hard at this. And you got to take me serious, because if you don't, I'm going to take you out. I'm going to take you out quick.
All right, you're talking a little big talk right now. I believe you, though, because of your championships. But, I mean, considering that a lot of folks would look at you and maybe limit you based on how you were born and what you look like, are there any advantages to only having one hand?
I mean, honestly, everyone faces adversity and everyone has things in their life that hold them back from doing the things that they want to do and reasons why they shouldn't do things. But in life, you can become a victim of the circumstances you're given, or you can create your own. And I worked hard to make sure that I didn't let myself be a victim or be categorized into what I can and can't do. I did what I felt like doing, and I did what I love. And I think one of the advantages, you don't have a lot of guys like me out there with one hand that can fight like I fight. So it's hard to find training partners to get ready for me. And all the ones that are good that have one hand are all my friends, so they're not going to help you.
Well, yeah, they're going to talk smack like you would too, probably. In 2015, you announced your retirement. Then you came back in 2018. Why'd you leave?
I had some things I wanted to do. I own my own business in Connecticut. I own a gym, and I kind of wanted to get that going and just think about my later years after I fight, have a plan after I fight and build something great there. So I have my gym, Fighting Arts Academy in Connecticut, and it's doing great. And I'm able to do that and still fight. So it's fantastic.
Okay, I had this research from our fine producers here at Banfield. According to Tapology.com, you have a pro MMA record of 16 wins, 4 losses. Your last fight was in June. When will you be back in the ring? When can we see you in action?
I got to talk with the people at Bellator, play my next one. Right now I have 2 little ones at home, so I'm kind of having fun with them and enjoying that and running my business and coaching fighters, working on this movie. And I got a lot of irons in the stove, I think they say. Is that the right saying? But
irons in the fire.
Irons in the fire.
Yeah.
I'm very busy, but I'm training hard every day.
Okay.
I just got back in actually before I got on this with you. So hopefully maybe before the end of the year.
All right. Well, let's watch some of you, your story in action from the film Notorious Nick. Let's watch.
Prove you belong.
Wrestle, Nick, wrestle. Get him to the ground.
Okay, he's technically asleep now, so nice going.
Cody Christian portraying you in the film. Did you think that this was a worthy depiction? And would you do things like this, where you were just going all the way and not letting go?
Yeah, I mean, if they don't tap and they pass out, that's on them, I guess. But I feel like Cody did a good job. Actually, he studied some of my movements and the way I throw punches and the way I throw kicks and kind of mimicked it really well. And the actors that he goes against in the movie, like the guy he just choked out right there, is named Eves Edwards, and he's a real fighter. So he had a lot of good people to work with and a lot of talented people on set to make sure that all the movements and everything was right.
And legit, because it has to look real, otherwise it's going to look cheesy. Were you happy with the fight scenes?
Yeah, I thought the choreography was really good. I know he trained really hard and worked on looking legit. I feel like one thing about martial arts movies is sometimes they can be really cheesy. But this one actually came out with good storytelling, good fight scenes, and it's just all around an entertaining movie.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about the movie when we come back from the break, so don't go anywhere. I'm going to talk to Nick about what it's like to see yourself on screen, and we'll take a look at some of the other scenes from those fights coming up next.
We're back with MMA fighter Nick Newell, his life the subject of the new film Notorious Nick. Okay, before we went to the break, one of our sound engineers asked me, well, Cody Christian didn't have one hand, so there was some special effects, a sleeve, right, that he had to wear to obviously look more like you. Can you hear me, Nick?
Yeah. So he wore a green screen.
Green sleeve, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, he did a good job. It's in my opinion, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at it and a lot of ways that people feel about it. But at the end of the day, it's good to have someone on the screen with one hand that's fighting, that's a positive influence, and not someone that just like got their arm chopped off by a sword or something stupid like that, or and show a real story of someone that was able to, that looked like you. And there's kids out there, you know, that watch a movie that look like me that can watch that and see like, okay, there was a guy out here that didn't give up and chased his dreams and made it happen.
Yeah, very inspiring.
I do that too, even if it's not in fighting, it's in something else.
Right.
When I was a kid, Jim Abbott was a baseball player, and I didn't end up being a baseball player. I just loved Jim Abbott, so it gave me the confidence to go do the things that I felt I needed to do and I wanted to do.
Right. Well, it is a beautiful story, especially for those who can use yours as an analogy for their own life. One more question for you. Obviously, the COVID pandemic affected a lot of us. One of your fights was canceled because of it. How did it change the sport? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of promoters who aren't going to force fighters to be vaccinated. So has your world changed? Has the world of fighting changed for you because of the pandemic?
No, we have to get like the test. We have to go a week early. I got the test, mm-hmm. and my fight got canceled because I tested positive, but I wasn't sick. I didn't even lose my taste or my smell or anything, and I just felt like a little groggy in the morning, and I was fine for the rest of the day. I know it affects everyone different. You know, I'm not for mandating anything. I believe, you know, that you should have a choice, and that's just how I feel, but other people will feel different about that. So, you know, it's a touchy subject.
Yeah, but you are going to continue fighting and you're going to enjoy it. We only have 30 seconds left. Any final words for viewers?
Yeah, you can watch my movie anywhere that you can download movies, so you can go on YouTube or on Amazon or
right.
pretty much anywhere. That you
Apple streaming, Netflix.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You can download the movie and watch it.
Thank you for reminding me of that. That's so true. Stream it now. Notorious Nick. Thank you so much, Nick Newell, for joining us. Enjoy your night. Ashley's back tomorrow.